Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. In July 2014, Washington Post Tehran Bureau Chief Jason Rezaian was arrested by Iranian police and accused of spying for the United States. Diplomatic stakes were high as he served out an 18-month prison term. This week, Jason Rezaian joins us to share his story, which he recounts in his new book, Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Jason Rezaian, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on today, Ray.
You know, one less talked about aspect of your experience has a very strong connection to what's been going on in the United States. Just before your captivity, and certainly during it, there was a hot domestic debate about solitary confinement, whether it constituted cruel and unusual punishment, whether it bordered on torture. There were really moving accounts of long-term solitary in various state prisons across the country, and a national debate about whether to use it. But, you know, those stories were almost entirely written by reporters who had never been in solitary confinement. What can you say about how that differs from normal incarceration?
Well, having experienced a little bit of both, and, you know, the latter and the majority of my incarceration was not in solitary, but with two other cellmates. The rest of the time, I was imprisoned in Evin in Iran, but still isolated from the general population. I can tell you that the sort of desperation and feelings of hopelessness when you're not allowed basic human contact sets in really quickly. I've read a fair amount about solitary since this happened to me and even before. And I always just assumed that, yeah, this is a pretty cruel and unusual way of treating people. Now I'm certain of it. And I don't think that there's any justification for it anywhere in the world. So I hoped in writing about that part of my experience that it could give some color and clarity to readers about what that is really like, and it's not pretty.
Did you have an evolution of how you were mentally handling it over the days?
Look, I think when you are first thrust into solitary confinement, you don't know what to make of it, and your hope and assumption is that it will end very quickly, and then it doesn't. And it drags on and on. I hear about people who have spent many, many times more time in solitary than I did. But I can't imagine getting through another day of it. And the specter and sort of insinuation that I might be returned to solitary at some point if I didn't behave properly was always in the back of my mind and something that my captors held over me. And I think that that's a very common tactic with people who've experienced it. Because once you've gotten out of it, the last thing in the world that you would want to ever endure again is a period of solitary confinement. And, you know, the scars, the mental scars of that are still things that I think we'll be working to undo for the rest of my life.
There is a residue of it, even though you're back in the world and you're with your wife and you're in a community that appreciates you and right now is feting you and celebrating you. There's still a residual stain of that time?
Certainly. I mean, anytime I'm in a room, I need to make sure I can open the door and close it myself. You know, where's my exit? How do I get out of here? And also the residuals of other aspects of confinement and the sort of imprisonment interrogation that I went through. You know, I write pretty clearly in the book that fortunately I was not the subject of any physical attacks on me, but I was under the constant threats of them. And I also, you know, spent a lot of my time blindfolded. So, you know, the sensory deprivation and the changes in how I experience light and sound are pretty profound and difficult to explain to somebody who hasn't experienced them. My sensitivities to light never existed before, but now, you know, I'm always trying to shy away from light. I spent, you know, the entire 544 days in cells that had lights on 24 hours a day. So, you know, those are some of the things that, although I've gotten some distance from the experience and you know, I am dealing with life and you know, moving forward and succeeding. It's the sort of thing that, you know, no amount of pats on the back or congratulations on a job well done can undo.
You write of the physical changes occasioned by your captivity, the things that were happening to your body. Do you still carry some of those effects? I mean, losing 40 pounds, depending on the person, sounds like a good idea. I don't know if you kept it off after you came home.
Unfortunately, I haven't kept most of it off. So a lot of it's back. I've dipped into the buffet line, you know, a couple times too many since I got back. My body is still very different. I think I'm, you know, leaner than I was before. Some people will laugh if they looked at me because, you know, I was a pretty big guy then than I am now. I'm stronger, you know, but at the same time, you know, I have digestive problems that I dealt with while I was in there. My vision has been affected, but most sort of difficult is respiratory issues that I picked up while I was in prison. I think you assume when you're in a dank place like I was that you're exposed to things that you shouldn't be breathing. And I, you know, I deal with breathing and respiratory issues that I never had before. Overall, though, I feel in better shape than I was at the time. I slept on the floor for many months, and then I slept on a steel cot with a couple of blankets on it. So, you know, I think I'll probably have lower back issues for the rest of my life. But those are all, you know, relatively small prices to pay, knowing that there's others that have been there for much longer than I have. And I'm here now and able to move forward with my life. It's a very different life than the one that my wife and I had envisioned for ourselves. But there are a lot of wonderful things for us to latch on to and be happy about.
One of the really skillfully done things in the book is that instead of telling us about the transitions you're making, you're showing us. You're expressing it in a way that doesn't say, and here on day 125, I did this and made this change. But we feel it in the way you tell the story. You move from being wary to merely careful to considered to, by the end, going for broke with your captors, answering questions with contempt, with sarcasm, with deception even. That journey from the Jason of day one to the Jason of day 540 is a fascinating walk. I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but you apparently took the measure of the people who held you, or tried to, over time.
You have to do what you can to keep yourself in the game mentally. And, you know, I did start to look at it as somewhat of a game or a play, you know. And everybody has a role that they're supposed to act out. And at certain points, you have to play opposing roles, even in your own situation. So, you know, I tried to appear malleable and compliant to my captors when I was in the prison. And anytime I was taken out of the prison, whether it was to court or to, you know, a handful of very perfunctory medical exams in hospitals away from the prison, I always use those opportunities to say, hey, I haven't done anything wrong. Whatever they're saying about me in the media is not true. Everything that the local media, everything that's being put on me, pinned on me, is a figment of these people's imagination. Whatever they're saying about me having, committed to my, admitting to my crimes, which is something that the Iranian state media said over and over and over again, that was done under duress, if anything. I don't know if I'm being drugged. I don't know. Anybody who's listening, you plead your case, right? And then when you get back to the prison walls, you realize, I'm here again, and I have to play the role of being subservient and living there by their rules. So, when I first set out to write this, I wanted to get all of this information down. And, it's no secret that a book or an article or anything that one writes and hopes to publish is going to go through multiple iterations. And I think early on, it was really about getting the details down. And if you read those early notes, it would have sounded like I was telling you. But I, as somebody who's spent years working as a writer, realized that that wasn't going to work. And so I had to really take you there. And if you can see that there are some very short sentences in the book, right? Less is more. And so oftentimes I would try and take that attitude into my interactions with my captors. Fewer words, and more carefully considered. And I hope that comes through in the read of this book.
Loud and clear. But during those early days when... you were waiting to see what this was, why you were being held, whether the intention was to keep you for a long time, whether there would be a show trial. Did you have to develop for yourself, or over time develop for yourself, a set of rules, almost a code that you were going to live by on the inside, to hold on to yourself, sure, but also as a part of your strategy for dealing with these people who meant you harm?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you have to be mindful of everything that you say and you do. And I did, over time develop those kinds of rules. And I think the main rule was, you recognize pretty early on that everything that they're telling you that is happening or could happen, everything that's being said about you in the world, the possible ramifications of these things, what they will do for you if you do for them. In almost every case, the 180 degree opposite was true. And I learned that over time. So, I would tell them, yeah, certainly, I'm going to do exactly what you say. When I get into court, I will plead guilty, because you're telling me that if I plead guilty, you're going to, pin a heavy sentence on me and then you're going to let me go home. That sounds plausible because you've seen it happen in other situations before. But I also had a wife who was telling me, hey, man, you didn't do anything wrong and neither did I. And we have a reputation and our families have reputations in this country as, law-abiding good citizens. The last thing I want is you going in front of the judge and saying that you committed any crimes, because you didn't. So that was a powerful incentive. I didn't want to piss off my wife. At the same time, I knew I was dealing with some really nasty characters. But I recognized that as the sphere of my experience grew, my wife and my mother were able to come and pay me visits from time to time, bring me some information from the outside world, coded often, about what was happening, in the international press and the efforts that my brother was making here in the United States. It gave me a certain amount of confidence that this ordeal would in all likelihood end, and that I, whether I pled guilty or didn't plead guilty, it wasn't based on what I was doing. It was based on forces beyond my control. So I chose to try and protect my dignity as much as I could.
Did the fact that you knew Iran pretty well make this easier to bear, or actually more tantalizing, more burdensome, more torturous, because there were things that you knew about this place? That some of the Americans who have been taken, and some of the Westerners who have been taken prisoner by the Islamic Republic over the years, have been in the country a matter of days, a matter of weeks.
Right.
But you knew it well. You spoke the language. I'm wondering whether that was a hindrance or a help.
I think it was probably both. But, in surviving day to day, relations with my captors, it was helpful. I had a cellmate who was from Azerbaijan, from the country of Azerbaijan, which, although it borders Iran and has a lot of cultural connections with Iran, is also very different. And, you know, as a former Soviet state, satellite state, it's not a place where people speak a lot of English. They either speak Azeri Turk or they speak Russian. And that cellmate had a really difficult time, you know, even more so than me. And I realized that my understanding of the culture and having grown up in an Iranian family and understanding the ways that there's sort of a ingrained passive-aggressiveness to some social interactions, that I could read through the tea leaves better than he could. And that was helpful. It was really something that made it easier for me. I realized, you know, fairly early on when it became clear that there would be a trial, that this was not a trial that I had any chance of winning, you know? So there were lots and lots of examples of how I was able to kind of incorporate what I knew about Iranian culture and mannerisms, but also, you know, how the state apparatus and their court systems work as well.
And you, well, maybe exploited is the wrong word, but you teased at that gap between stated policy and what was really happening to you, sometimes to embarrass them and get some things you wanted.
Had to, right? And I think they believe that they are doing the right thing. They believe that that God is on their side and they're on God's side. I mean, you know, that's what a theocracy is, right? And so anytime you could poke holes in what they were doing to you, you know, does it say in the Quran that you can, you know, separate people from their families and lock them up in cages and, you know, not let them defend themselves? Does it say that you can do this? How are you going to answer to God, you know, if you execute me or if you steal another day of my life for crimes that I didn't commit? And, you know, as I write in the book, I mean, faith is every person's own personal prerogative, and whether you have it or not is up to you. But I realize that in that place, in that setting, calling them out for their hypocrisy and their breaking of their own Islamic traditions and rules was going to be to my advantage.
But the very idea that faith is a personal prerogative is not widely held in post-revolutionary Iran, or perhaps it's privately held, but not publicly
right.
held. You don't have that
right.
that freedom of movement. They wanted you, I would guess, to be more of a devout Muslim. They wanted you to pray. They wanted you to read Quran, and you weren't cooperating in that regard.
Well, I read the Quran. I did. As you know, at some point, my main interrogator came to me and said, "You know, you don't pray. You know, they have cameras in your cell, and you know, they're following you around, and they know what you do and you don't do. How can you, you know, call yourself a Shia Muslim if you don't pray?" And I thought to myself, well, I don't actually call myself a Shia Muslim. I call myself an American. I call myself a human. I call myself a lot of things. But one thing that I don't really identify with is that part of my background. Although my father's family and you know, for many generations back, are Shia. But I, again, used it as an opportunity. I said, well, how do you think I'm going to pray if I haven't even read the Quran? I mean, this is ridiculous. At that point, I was in solitary confinement, and I didn't have anything to, you know, pass the time with. So they brought me a Quran, and I read it. It was the first thing I was able to read during that period. And, you know, there's important lessons in there, just like there are in any religious text. But it didn't take in the way that they might have hoped.
Would your captivity have been different if you were sort of a conventional Shia?
It's hard to say. I don't know. I mean, I think it would have been different if I was born and raised in Iran and didn't have this second nationality, in good ways and in bad ways. You know, I never would have been arrested in the first place if I wasn't an American citizen. They needed an American for, you know, they need an American hostage for leverage in negotiations. I also think, though, that that I might have been treated worse if I was a local person who, you know, had fallen into their hands for whatever reason. So, you know, it's a ultimate catch-22. And I think the fact that I was an American and an Iranian citizen with, you know, deep connections to the United States of America, to a major media organization, was part and parcel of why I was taken in the first place. So I can't really dissociate the two things.
I was a young reporter during the Islamic Revolution. I was on the runway in Algiers when the American hostages walked out in their first steps of freedom after 444 days. This is a story that's been a big part of the early part of my career. And one of the journalistic cliches of the time was whenever Evin Prison was mentioned, it had a descriptor. It was the notorious Evin Prison. What makes it notorious? Yeah. What did you have a sense of why it struck fear into ordinary Iranians once you were in it?
So I think that notorious nature has evolved over time. And, you know, I think there's a more of a international perception of the place and an understanding of what goes on there. And for that reason, you know, advocacy groups, human rights groups have had an influence on how inhumane the prison staff can and can't be. I think at this point, the infamy or notoriety of Evin Prison is the fact that it's known for housing detainees, hostages, prisoners who did nothing more than either express themselves, disagree with state policy, or in my case, you know, be a national of a foreign country. The place is littered with us. And, you know, there are different sections of Evin Prison. It's a vast complex in a very highly touted, you know, part of Tehran. I mean, it's in the northern part of the city on the side of a mountain. You know, I'm sure that there are real estate speculators that are waiting for the day for it to be torn down and turned into villas. You know, there's rivers that run by it. But it's a place that's also known for people going in and never coming out. So, you know, there's a lot of images and thoughts that it conjures. In my particular case, I was being housed in a section of the prison that is dedicated to detaining the prisoners, hostages, captives of the Revolutionary Guard Corps' intelligence unit. So there's also, you know, parts of the prison for the regular Ministry of Intelligence, for the police force, for the army, and for the Navy. The judiciary has a holding area for people who are awaiting trial. Lots of different sections of the prison that are overseen by, you know, the authorities from those different branches of government or military. In the case of Section 2A, which is where I was, the Revolutionary Guard Corps and their intelligence wing has created this sort of bubble around itself. It's similar in a way to, you know, Guantanamo, in the sense that it's beyond oversight. You know, that everybody that's in there is accused of a national security crime, and no other branch of the government, whether it's the parliament, the judiciary, you know, the so-called Human Rights Commission, they've got no right to enter into Section 2A and see what's going on there. And that's what makes that part of the prison particularly notorious. And it's also where the vast majority of foreign nationals who've been held in recent years are housed.
During your confinement, from the story you tell, it becomes apparent that, as at least for members of the Revolutionary Guard, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. They've read your reporting on the very small ways that other cultures in other parts of the world make themselves felt and understood in Iran, and yet their imperfect understanding of some a story of yours on people who like to play baseball in Iran, kidding about starting an avocado industry in Iran so that they can know the pleasures of guacamole. They understand it, but they don't understand it. Were you at times taken by the level of knowledge of your otherwise reputed to be austere, pious people of Western pop culture?
I think that that was the thing that struck me most. These are people who are completely devout in their own minds, devout to, you know, the religion, but also to the hierarchy of the power system there. And they believe that it's their sole purpose in life to defend the Islamic Republic, not the sanctity of Islamic Republic, but the existence of it. So, you know, it's their right to try and root out anything that might be considered a threat. At the same time, Iranians are consumers of global popular culture, just like the citizens of any other country. I mean, anywhere you go these days, people know the same pop musicians and film stars and video games that we do here in the United States or in Europe. So I think that they crave access to those ideas and products, but also had sort of a abhorrence of themselves for craving those things. It's a very complicated situation, but ultimately they've put themselves in a vacuum that says, okay, by the very nature of the fact that this guy is writing a story about baseball, a game that is somehow, you know, considered the pastime of the United States of America, so, you know, emblematic or representative of the great Satan, this must be a plot to undermine us. They can draw that parallel, connect those dots in seemingly any set of circumstances that are presented in front of them, because that's all they are told to do. And that's a very difficult place for somebody who's been, you know, born and raised in the United States of America, educated in our school system, educated in our higher educational system. That's, you know, those aren't the critical thinking skills that I was raised with.
During the early revolutionary period, some of the people who came to the fore and spoke for the revolution to the West were people who had spent significant time in Western Europe, in
right.
North America, who had been to university, who had studied engineering, who knew English, who knew German and French. And they understood the world that they were talking to in a way that I'm guessing your guards didn't.
That's 100% correct. I mean, I think there was a moment during the revolution and that period where, you know, the people that were involved and those that you spoke about that had been educated or lived here in the West for long periods of time, you know, they were responding to what they saw as a imperial situation, right, where America had kind of taken too much influence within Iran, and that the Shah was too much of a lapdog to Western, to Washington. As you know, I mean, in the early months of that revolution and right up till the end, there were a lot of groups vying for influence and power, and it was not a Islamic revolution. The Islamic Republic was born out of that revolution, but it wasn't an Islamic revolution on its face. It was an, you know, anti-imperial revolution. And, you know, these ruthless, brutal theocrats were the ones that won. And I think that notion that, you know, we should send people out into the world and pick up an understanding of how the rest of the world works is one that's at great odds within the system. I mean, I think there's two camps. There's the camp that wants to see Iran as a society that's closed off and self-contained almost, that doesn't need other countries and doesn't need relations with the rest of the world to thrive. And then there's the other camp that sees the need to not only engage with other countries politically and, you know, for security and strategic purposes, but also the need for economic interaction and the flow of people and information. And I think that this is the great, you know, people talk about moderates and hardliners in Iran all the time. There are no Jeffersonian Democrats in the Iranian power system. It's not part of the establishment there to be seeking secular values at this point. It's an Islamic system. It's an Islamic system with sets of people who want to see it closed off from the rest of the world and sets of people who realize that for its survival, it can't be closed off from the rest of the world. And that's what the great debate in Iran has been over for the past 20 years.
We've been hearing from Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian. He was imprisoned while reporting in Iran. After the break, we'll discuss his part in the Iran nuclear deal and the role of journalism in defending democracy. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Jason Rezaian. He's a journalist for The Washington Post and the author of a new book, Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program with Ray Suarez.
If you're a reporter who works most of your career in the United States, you don't get to talk to many Iranians who aren't people who've left the whole thing behind, who have completely relocated to the United States. But every now and then, in international conferences, you get to talk to these various stripes of Iranians, and they have some similarities. Often they're quite patriotic. They are lovers of the historic Persian culture. They are people who want respect. But what that means coming out of those two different groups of people is so different. One group is ready to scare the world in order to get that respect, while another faction thinks we're not taken seriously as a country. So we have to, if we have to break a little China in order to get our due, a big country with an old civilization and a very sophisticated one, well, we're going to break that China. They are not the same people. They are not talking about the same things. They don't always talk with the same level of sophistication. But there is a yearning among Iranians of various stripes, it seems to me, to be understood, to be respected, and to be given the same kind of deference that they see other countries with other old cultures getting.
Agreed, 100%. What I would say is that, you know, in terms of how the Iranian power structure, how the state thinks about this, you know, is, I call it, you know, their cake and eat it too mentality. On the one hand, they want to be respected, all of them, right? Everybody wants to be respected. They want to be seen as a large and an important country because they are. It's 80 million people. It's a huge piece of land. It has important commercial and cultural ties going back millennia with all of its neighbors. You know, it's a powerhouse in that region. There's no doubt about that. At the same time, They've decided that they don't want to play by international rules. They want a seat at the big kids' table, but they don't want to necessarily play by the rules of the big kids. And that's, I think, you know, a defining problem for Iran, for all of its leadership at this point. I mean, we look at how they deal with, I mean, and this is why I think my story is important. In the continuum of Iran's hostage taking, you know, you alluded to covering the release of, you know, the hostages in 1981. It's 40 years that Iran has been doing this thing that terrorist groups and pirates do. States don't do this, but Iran continues to do it. So, you know, there's a real disconnect. And honestly, Ray, I don't think that the authorities in Iran understand how damning their hostage-taking ways have been to their international reputation. Because if they did, they wouldn't keep doing it. So, you know, there's a problem there that they need to square themselves. And I think that a lot of people in power in other countries are, frankly, tired of Iranian antics. And, you know, I don't think they get a lot of sympathy in Western capitals. I think they lean on their relationships with Russia and China. But even those countries, I mean, you saw it in the nuclear negotiations, you know, started in 2012 and culminating in 2016. Russia and China were on board with all of those sanctions, you know, because the case against Iran was a pretty strong one.
One of the infuriating and confusing things about your own confinement and your own story is that you weren't in your reporting trafficking in state secrets. You are helping to explain Iran to an American reader who really, in many cases, carries the handed down ideas about Iran that date from the 70s and 80s and are not particularly flattering. And you were, in some ways, I think, a very useful corrective to the misapprehensions that Westerners have about what goes on day to day inside that society. And instead of throwing you in jail, it might have been a handier thing to just let you do your work, because your work made Americans understand Iran better than they would in any other way, and certainly better than they come away from a story like you being sent to prison for more than 500 days.
Well, I think that's the, you know, again, there's a divide within that system. I mean, you know, the international face of Iran, President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif, stood to lose a lot by me being taken and held for as long as I was. You know, this is a blight on their record, on this idea that Iran is a safe country that's open for business. And they did very little to kind of distance themselves from the taking of me. I mean, they supported everything that was said about me by the Revolutionary Guard and the judiciary. You know, they did as much as anybody to sully my name and slander me, even here in the United States of America, when they would come to the UNGA. So I think, again, it's part of that cake and eat it too mentality. They want the world to respect them, and, you know, they think that they've been, you know, disrespected and treated unfairly in our media. But I've got a great example. One of my colleagues who was covering the negotiations in Europe tells it that she was sitting down with a press representative from the Iranian mission. I think it was in Vienna. And they were having a conversation about Iran, and he was complaining about how poorly Iran is portrayed in Western media. And she's sitting there listening, and, you know, I'd been in prison for over a year at this point. And he's going on and on and on, and finally he says, you know, you should really come to Tehran and see what it's really like and write some reports about the true nature of our country and the vibrant society. And she got up from the table and she looked at him and she said, you know, we have a correspondent in Iran, and he's been behind bars in your country for over a year. So, you know, I don't think I'll be coming there anytime soon, and walked away. And unfortunately, You know, my arrest and my imprisonment has had a chilling effect on journalists in Iran, based in Iran, others who would like to cover Iran, news organizations in America especially, who would like to have a foothold in Iran the way that we at the Post did for all those years. But that's not going to happen as long as what happened to me keeps happening, and it continues to happen. So, you know, I think we can't really exonerate Iran from this until they stand up, take responsibility for it, and stop doing it.
The Javads and Zarifs and the Rouhanis try to have it both ways, don't they? They distance themselves 100%. From the excesses of the Revolutionary Guard when they're embarrassing, and then pretend they're all fingers on the same hand when they're not embarrassing.
Exactly. And I think that you know, we live in a world where because of our access to information and the ability to spread information so quickly, whether it's, you know, through our social media platforms or our cell phones, it's very hard to not be transparent. And so when you have these conflicting sort of posturings to the world, it comes off as incredibly hypocritical. And I think that when you're talking about, you know, authoritarian, ideologically driven states, hypocrisy is really their bread and butter. But it's so easy to poke holes in these days, easier than ever. And I'm one that's hopeful that, you know, we can move past these regimes of isms sooner rather than later, because you know, they just don't they don't hold water anymore.
But have you come to any conclusions, durable or not, about what the real nature of that relationship is? There are these separate power centers in Iran. Sometimes they seem to be moving in tandem. Sometimes they seem to be moving at cross purposes. Can President Rouhani distance himself from some of these other power centers over which he has no control? Can he only go so far in acknowledging excesses or apologizing? Like, are they on the same side or are they not on the same side?
I think they're on the same side in the sense that they all realize that the continuity and existence of the Islamic Republic as a system of power is in their best interest. And the last thing that any of them want to see is for this this entity to dissolve. So, yeah, I think that they're in a very tangled, symbiotic relationship. It's a long marriage and one that, you know, probably ends when they all die.
Well, that's kind of final and abrupt. But we have seen leading lights of the Islamic State pass on, move to their eternal reward, and the system keep cranking along as it was before. People who were thought to be essential, people of whom there were articles written, what happens after this person dies? Is there a certain motive power to the state that keeps it in business even when leading personalities of the revolution are no longer around or no longer able to use power?
On February 11th, we're coming up on that very quickly. The Islamic Republic will celebrate, for lack of a better word, 40 years of existence as an entity. In that time, they had a revolutionary leader in Ayatollah Khomeini who came back and led the country for 8 years. They also fought this 8-year-long war with Iraq in the 1980s. These two things, I mean, the arrival of Khomeini and the war with Iraq still dominate the rhetoric, the imagery, the idea of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution. Fewer and fewer people can remember that period of time. And I think as distance grows from that, as the years wear on, and people are less able to really feel that, the pull of these ideals is going to diminish dramatically. And I think that that's what that group of people who want to see the country closed off from the world fear most. When my interrogator, who is, you know, a self-professed defender of the regime and the revolution, tells me that he wants Will Smith to play him in the movie. I kind of feel like these guys have some problems that they don't necessarily see coming.
Were you, in their eyes, by telling the stories of day-to-day life in Iran, threatening, undermining, eroding the authority of the current Iranian government?
I think that my captors and the people that were dealing with me on a day-to-day basis had to convince themselves that I was threatening. But that as time wore on, they realized, no, this guy is no threat to us or anything else. All he's doing is stating the obvious about what's happening around us. Now, if that's a threat to them and all that they hold dear, that should tell you a bit about how stable their footing is.
So we're not going to see some new approach toward press freedom with them handing out a lot of new press cards. Are there people who also have some influence in the upper reaches of the society that say, no, actually it would be better if a Canadian understood what day-to-day life was like here?
Look, I mean, for years there have been people, in the Western missions of the Islamic Republic, whether it was in New York or Washington, across Europe, who hand out visas to people and come and say, we want to help you do whatever you can, because I think that they realize these, mid-level diplomats who spent years and years living in the West realize the importance of having, international media covering their country in a way that, even if they don't wholly agree with it, is more representative than the reading of Iran that we've had for much of the last 40 years. But that goes in ebbs and flows. And, anytime there's a moment of protest or upheaval inside Iran, they try and turn off that valve of information. That's becoming harder and harder as, normal citizens can take pictures of themselves or video of themselves on the street protesting and get it out to the world in a matter of seconds. I think that whether or not they want to shut off how people view Iran or talk about day-to-day life there, it's a losing battle. They can't do it.
Yet, if you go as a reporter, if you get a visa, a limited stay visa, and talk to the country about your plans for a reporting trip, they follow you, they watch you, mm-hmm. they infiltrate your in-country production team with spies who report back sure. nightly, and begin the work of discrediting you so they can kick you out.
It's happened time and time and time again. I think that, the process that you just explained was one that I've seen unfold in front of me dozens of times. It's 4.5 years now since I walked the streets of Tehran, in relative freedom. I don't know if that's still happening. I think that just the number of visas that have been given to people have diminished, substantially for reporting purposes. And I don't know if that's still exactly how they do it, or if they've just decided to stop letting people in.
Can this go on? I mean, it's at the time of the revolution, people said that this was not a sustainable model. And look at how wrong they were. I mean, there you are talking about the upcoming 40th anniversary. This manages to hang on, even with the internal contradictions, even with the yearning of many Iranians to push off some of the strictures that have come with the revolutionary government. I mean, is this looking good for the long haul?
I don't think so. I mean, but I don't understand or pretend to have a clue about how it's going to turn into whatever it turns into next. I mean, I think the likelihood that it opens up and becomes a thriving secular democracy, although I'd love to see that happen, is not being fostered right now. I mean, we hear a lot from the current administration in the United States that, they want to do everything they can to help the aspirations of the free-loving Iranian people. Well, we've also implemented some of the toughest sanctions we ever have after a deal that was supposed to remove those sanctions permanently because Iran agreed to certain steps over its nuclear activities. At the same time, we've also blocked Iranians from traveling to this country. You know, they're the country that's most affected by the travel ban. So, you know, I think that if we want to be on the side of the Iranian people, we should show it in different sorts of ways and help give them the opportunities and the resources to at least, you know, crack some holes into the system and open up the society bit by bit. But unfortunately, as usual, I don't see anybody on the side of the good people of that country.
When you were finally released during the waning time of the Obama administration and since the change in administration in Washington, have official people tried to pick your brain, find out what you know, get a sense of your point of view of what the country's like, what the system's like, who's in charge, who's approachable?
On an occasional basis, I'll engage in conversations with people at the post, you know, visiting delegations from different countries or American diplomats. You know, I talk to people on the Hill every once in a while. You know, my main concern and my main offer is, you know, I'd like to help however I can bring Americans detained in Iran home. And I think that that's where my insights might be most valuable. But, you know, as far as the current administration goes, you know, I've talked to people at very high levels. I've talked to the Secretary of State and I've talked to people, you know, in his team that works on Iran, not in any official capacities. We run into each other at events and, you know, I tell them what I think they're getting wrong. And I think it's my right to do that as a taxpayer. But them seeking me out for my information and possible understanding of the place, no, that really hasn't happened.
Was there a point during your captivity when, because of outside events, you felt like some of the power was moving to your side of the table?
Certainly. I mean, I think that as time wore on, as I realized that the nuclear negotiations were coming to a head and ultimately to an agreement, I was fairly certain that that would lead to my ultimate release. When that didn't happen in July of 2015, when the JCPOA was signed, it was a period of great despair for me because I realized this could take longer, could take much longer. I could see, you know, from the Iranian news reports that I was seeing on the television in my cell, that, you know, there was a belief and a plan to implement the various points of the nuclear deal in January of 2016. And I thought to myself, okay, that there's the moment. And if I get out, it's going to be then. And if I don't, I'm probably not going to get out anytime soon. And we've seen that, you know, all the people that were there at the time of my release and others who've been taken since are all still there. So, you know, I was sort of on the, you know, dancing on a knife blade for those last few months. And the fact that that it culminated in the way that it did, although this should never happen to me and I certainly shouldn't have spent a year and a half, you know, imprisoned and separated from my family, I'm happy with how it ended.
Was the United States ready to sign that deal, whether you got out or not?
My understanding of it is that you know, the secret negotiations for the release of myself and other Americans began about 14 months before my release, 4 months into my imprisonment. Secretary of State John Kerry, somebody I've spoken with multiple times since I got out, and made it very clear to me that that he had made it clear in his negotiations that that the sanctions would be lifted and that the Iranians would receive their money and that Iranian prisoners in America would be freed, and that, you know, myself and other Americans would be freed. It was a complex set of different negotiations that ultimately played out and was implemented almost simultaneously in a matter of hours. So I think that it was made clear and that it was always the intention that while the negotiations were separate entities. It was a deal that was going to require freeing Americans.
Could you climb back on that horse and start working in other parts of the world as a correspondent again without this experience always in the back of your mind?
I don't know yet. And I think that, you know, the Post has been great about how they've worked me back into a role. You know, I am an opinions writer now. I'm a columnist. I write a lot about Iran and U.S.-Iran relations, which is great because I don't think there's anybody working in the country that's got more in-depth experience than I do in recent years. And I also write a lot about press freedom issues. And I think one thing I would like to do is get out into the world and write about those issues in other places because I think that they're very critical. It's in a very important time for our ability as humans to express ourselves. We have the opportunity to do it more easily, but there are major restrictions in so many different countries, and how those restrictions are implemented is different from one place to the next. And I'd like to help be a part of understanding that. But, you know, I can't really imagine right now being based in another country for a long period of time. I'd like to go out and do reports occasionally from different countries, but it feels pretty good to be in America at this point.
There is a lot of criticism from official circles of the American news business. Are we, who work in it, being careful enough, both in how we do our work, but also in keeping faith with the public? Are there, to your dismay, large numbers of Americans who feel like they could take or leave a free and independent press?
So this is something that I worry about a lot and I talk about a lot whenever I get a chance to. I think the notion that people trust us less and less, I've seen the polls and I hear people say that and I see it on social media and hear people saying it on TV. I also go and speak, in venues all over the country and have people telling me that they trust the Washington Post and the New York Times and their local newspapers more than they trust their elected officials. So it's a combative and kind of a adversarial relationship, and in some ways that's the way it's supposed to be. But, you know, what I worry about is that we've become, as a people, you know, it's such a made-to-order society at this point, that, you know, we consume the news and ideas that fortify our own pre-existing beliefs. And that doesn't really bode well for democracy. I think that right now our work as journalists is so important. The stuff we do really matters. It's a critical time where there's so much great journalism being produced right now. But in some ways, it's not having as much of an impact as it should. And that's something that I worry about deeply.
Jason Rezaian is the author of Prisoner. It's a memoir of his time in prison in Iran. Jason Rezaian, great to talk to you.
It's a pleasure, Ray. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Jason Rezaian. He's a journalist for The Washington Post and author of the book entitled Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison. This program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.